review the development of humanism from the Greek sophists up to the liberal humanism of our day, then set forth the fundamental differences between these earlier forms of humanism and Marxism, and then went on to characterize the socialist humanism fermenting in the Soviet bloc as a profoundly progressive cultural and political phenomenon expressing the resentment and resistance of the intellectuals and working masses there against the abominations of the bureaucratized regime. Today, I want to deal first with the socialist humanism in the capitalist world and note its differences with the socialist humanism in the Soviet bloc. And from this type of socialist humanism, which tends to shear away from the materialist foundations of Marxism, I want to go over and briefly note some of the principal features of a genuine socialist humanism, as I understand it. As I remarked at the beginning, socialist humanism is a worldwide cultural phenomenon. We find it in the Soviet bloc and in the intellectual capitals of the West. There is, of course, an ideological kinship between the two, but there can be very sharp differences between the social and political functions of socialist humanism in the Soviet zone and in the capitalist environment. These Soviet humanists are in the vanguard of a revolutionary current. Not all of them, because there are also mixed in with the correct reaction of these rebels, some tendencies which not always consciously wish to accommodate themselves with bourgeois democracy or some forces of the old order. But these are subsidiary and they do not determine the principal nature of Soviet humanism. The Soviet humanists face a ruthless enemy, entrenched holders of state power who will stop at nothing to hold it. The fate of the Hungarian communist writers, the best communist fighters there, is an indication of that. When they speak and write as they do, they risk their careers, their liberties, their lives. The socialist humanists who are operating in the capitalist West have a more ambiguous character. Insofar as their humanism becomes an ideological lever for promoting a break with the Stalinist perversions of socialism, or the social democratic hesitations to go forward towards socialism. Insofar as their ideas open a road to genuine Marxism in theory and practice, it has and continues to have a liberating effect. But it may also work in an opposite sense. Humanism can become the pretext not simply for breaking loose from Stalinism and social democratic reformism, but for leaving the ground of dialectical materialism altogether, for renouncing the policies flowing from a realization of the paramount role of the class struggle, and to shaping ideas to the prejudices of a middle class and ultimately a liberal reformist outlook. In the first case, humanism can serve to bring its advocates closer to an unfalsified revolutionary Marxist. In the other case, it can propel its proponents onto a wrong path. And in analyzing the progress of any avowed socialist humanist or any group of them, it's necessary to observe in which of these directions he or they are heading. As you will remember, I pointed out that liberal humanism can either become the last stopping place on the road to a socialist position and to scientific socialism, or else it can become one of the first halting places in the journey away from Marxism. I could speak of a group of this type, of ex-Communist Party intellectuals, headed by Professors E.P. Thompson and John Saville, who edit another magazine recently appearing in England called The New Reasoner. They too have raised the banner of a Soviet humanism in their breakaway from the Communist Party. But in recoiling against the outrages of Stalinism as they have run up against them, they incline to throw out the materialist basis of Marxism in favor of a moralistic and utopian brand of socialist theory. They are trying to insert a foundation of morality underneath Marxism, whereas, as we know, if we have at all grasped the essence of Marxism, it first of all lays down a materialistic foundation in theory, and out of this and upon this arises the morality concordant with the needs of the struggle for reconstructing society by the working class. But let us go from England to our own country. Here in the United States, the demand for a more humane approach to the solution of social problems is a persistent theme of the reformist socialist and ex-Trotskyist writers assembled around the magazine called Dissent. I don't know how many of you have heard about this magazine or read it regularly.
Can you repeat your formulation about your statement about
this? Here in the United States, there is a demand for a more humane approach to the solution of social problems. It's a persistent theme of the reformist socialist and ex-Trotskyist writers assembled around the magazine Dissent. This line of thought is also being taken up by a number of people who have recently broken ties with the Communist Party, although they have not such a clearly worked out viewpoint as the editors of Dissent magazine. One of its editors is Irving Howe, a literary critic who received his initial education, I believe, in our movement, went over and joined the Shachtmanites, and has recently written a history of the American Communist Party. In the winter of 1947, he wrote an article called A First Word on Sputnik. It was his reaction to that magnificent achievement of propelling the first satellite around the globe. 57. Here is what he said. The major problem of our world is no longer, assuming for the moment that it ever was, the development of technology. I want to repeat that sentence to you. The major problem of our world is no longer, assuming for the moment that it ever was, the development of technology. Advances in technology, he goes on to say, bring no necessary good. When controlled by repressive governments, they can cause pain and harm to many people. And if they seem to solve certain problems, it is only by bringing into existence new and at times more difficult problems. The need of our time remains the ordering of a humane society, the creation of human relations among human beings. And that is why one remains a socialist. The first reaction, at least my first reaction, of a scientific socialist to this lamentation is the light-minded way in which the author, who claims to be a Marxist, tosses aside, almost in passing, as though it were a trifle, the materialist foundations of Marxism. What was the beginning, the essence of Marxism that distinguished it from all previous brands of philosophy, from bourgeois idealism, bourgeois rationalism, which was the theoretical basis of humanism, and from utopian socialism? Marxism taught, for the first time, that the construction of a humane society in which there could be solidarity amongst all human beings depended upon a high development of technology along with the productive forces of society as a whole. And it taught, even before that, that it was primarily because enough wealth had been produced to take care of the cultural development of a few, but not of the many, that class society had been necessary since the breakup of primitive tribal life. However, our humanist tells us that advances in technology bring no necessary good, that when they're controlled by repressive governments, they cause harm and bring pain. Now, the historical superficiality of that is really remarkable. What novelty is it to learn that reactionary forces can misuse progressive achievements, that Hitler can create V-2 rockets, marvels of technology, and destroy cities in order to enslave as much humanity as his fascism could. Of course, the current world crisis drives home this lesson with emergency emphasis, but the conclusion to be drawn from that is that the workers, now more than ever, are obliged to take over the means of destruction along with the means of production. And as a matter of fact, you really can't separate the two. But from this situation, what do the new humanists infer? That is, insofar as they do not yet dare to assert it. They teach us, and they don't come out forthrightly and do it, they sneak up on it the way Howe does. They infer that the materialist premises of Marxism and the political practice based upon them has to be given up because somehow they obstruct the road to the creation of human relations among human beings. We say, on the contrary, you cannot find the road to the creation of human relations among human beings unless you understand the key role played by technology and the social relations of production which flows from the technological development of society. Now, let us go on to find out what is the real relation between Marxism and humanism. They are rather close. It happens that Marxism, in its birth process, did pass through a humanistic stage. During the 1840s, in his evolution from Hegelian idealism, which he espoused in his university days, to dialectical materialism, the youthful Marx, and also Engels to some extent, at one point adhered briefly to humanism and called his philosophy by that name. If you will read some of his writings from 1842 to 1844 or 5, you will see that this is the case. That was why, while Marx was an avowed disciple of Feuerbach. Just as Marx was a radical democrat before becoming a communist, so he was a humanist in philosophy before he emerged as a full-fledged materialist. Those intellectuals who are hunting for the causes of Stalinist or social democratic perversions of Marxism have seized upon this historical fact for their own purposes. Just as the Protestant reformers went back to the original Gospels to find an uncorrupted Christianity, so these socialist reformers are going back to the earliest writings of Marx in order to find some unpolluted sources of socialist theory. As a result of their researches, however, they arrive at extremely one-sided conclusions. They exaggerate the similarities and even identities between Marxism and humanism, while they fail to show wherein they essentially differ and even conflict with each other. They don't bother to explain what elementary scrupulousness in theory would necessitate explaining, why Marx and Engels revised and repudiated the humanism they learned from Feuerbach in favor of the superior philosophy of dialectical materialism. Let me explain it for them. In philosophy, as in other fields of knowledge, the creators of Marxism incorporated into their own theory whatever remained valid and valuable in earlier schools of thought. They did this not only with the materialism of Feuerbach and the French encyclopedists of the 18th century, they not only did this with the dialectical logic of Hegel, but also with the viable elements of the humanist tradition in the Western world. The major theoretical difference between their kind of humanism and all previous forms of humanism is that the latter were based to one degree or another upon non-materialist premises, especially in the fields of history, sociology, and politics. Marxist humanism, on the other hand, became solidly integrated in a comprehensive and consistent materialist viewpoint. When they weaken or discard these materialist foundations, the neo-socialist humanists of England and America wipe out the advance made by Marxism. They obliterate the fundamental distinction between bourgeois humanism, even of the most left, progressive, and liberal type, and a genuine socialist humanism, whether they realize it or not. They are not passing beyond Stalinism or social democracy. They are pulling socialist theory back to an infantile and pre-scientific stage which it has long since outgrown. So much for this kind of socialist humanism. Now, what should a genuine socialist humanism stand for? To be a Marxist, it is not necessary to renounce humanism. But it is certainly anti-Marxist to surrender the revolutionary outlook of dialectical materialism in order to embrace humanism. It is all a question of order in integrating these elements. Which is subordinate to the other? Is the valuable tradition of Western humanism to be subordinated to the new materialist insights of Marxism, or on the contrary, are these new materialist insights to be trampled upon and thrown away in favor of a sliding back to one form or another of liberal humanism? The humanism which rightfully belongs with scientific socialists has to be approached historically. It has to be seen as the vintage of a series of intellectual and social movements reaching back to the Mediterranean civilizations of antiquity. You will remember that yesterday I reviewed the history of humanity, pointing out the main stages of humanism: Greek humanism, Renaissance humanism, democratic humanism, liberal humanism. Greek humanism, Renaissance humanism, the democratic humanism of the bourgeois era, all embodied successive efforts by enlightened forces of their age to bring social relations under the control of human reason. Each of these endeavors pushed mankind a step forward. But as we know, because we can look back over their accomplishments, they all fell short of their highest aims. Why? Because each of them in turn ran up against insurmountable barriers resulting from the inadequate development of the powers of production. Under Greek slave society, bourgeois society in its various stages of development, and the resultant limitations of their class social structure. Under different circumstances and in various ways, these humanist thinkers expressed the aspiration that civilized man has retained and developed, that mankind could become, as Lord Bacon said, the master and possessor of nature, and thereby reconstruct society so that the human personality could flourish without restriction. Since the requisite technology, the requisite economic conditions and social forces were lacking to fulfill these aims to perfection, what survived from these earlier movements was the optimistic hope that by reliance upon our own powers, mankind could and would convert the natural and social environments into means for subserving the highest aims that the human mind could envisage. Now, what is the relation between scientific socialism and these unrealized visions of the humanism of the past? Scientific socialism willingly and consciously took over the noble goals of mastering nature, creating reasonable relations among men, and perfecting the human personality which humanism had first projected. It undertook to demonstrate, first in theory and later partially in practice, how these premises of humanism could be realized. Socialism proceeded from the science and technique and the immense productive potential of large-scale industry developed under capitalism. It said that the working class would have to win political supremacy, concentrate the means of production under state ownership and control, and proceed to reconstruct the social system from top to bottom in a planned and rational manner. Socialist humanism rests upon the following four propositions. First, capitalist ownership is the principal block to the development of the material means for achieving social solidarity and human happiness. Second, the industrial working class is the only social force which, by virtue of its economic function and its social position, is vitally interested and consistently compelled to get rid of capital. Third, capitalist power and property can be abolished only by carrying the mass struggle against its defenders and beneficiaries to its conclusion, not only in a single country, not only in several countries, but on a world scale. Fourth, the road to a harmonious and classless society has to pass through the gate of the World Socialist Revolution, in order to eliminate the root causes of conflict between one part of mankind and another, between the developed nations and the undeveloped nations, between the classes in society. This revolutionary class program and outlook decisively separates Marxism from all varieties of bourgeois humanism, which are tied up with liberalism, progressivism, and reformism. If you will read Corliss Lamont's work on humanism, which I referred to yesterday, you will find that his fundamental viewpoint clashes with these propositions. They are not to be found in his work. That was socialist humanism up to the time when Stalinism came upon the scene as an important phenomenon in the world labor and political movement. Since the rise of Stalinism, Marxism has added a fifth proposition. It teaches that the workers have not thrown the capitalists off their backs. The colonial people have not thrown the imperialists off their backs, so that any new masters in the shape of tyrannical bureaucrats or insolent functionaries can take their place. Socialist humanism demands democratic self-rule by the workers and strict control over all the servants of their government, until such professional functionaries and the state itself are no longer needed. Just as the workers in the unions have to control their officials and be able to remove them at any time by referendum and recall, so the workers, where they have taken power and abolished capitalism, have to have the right by democratic means to tell anybody up on top, you are not serving us right, you get out of your office, go back to the bench, and let somebody be put in your place who can serve us and not trample upon our needs and our desires. That may, expression may be religious in phrase, but the content I agree. Society forms people. That's a simple proposition, which is the basis of all materialist thinking in sociology. That's what Marx meant when he wrote, there is no such thing as abstract man or human nature in general. Men are the totality of their social conditions, or the social conditions required for their production, taking for granted, of course, their biological conditions. And as social conditions change from age to age and from one stage of development to another, the characteristics and activities of people change along with them. There's nothing distinctively Marxist about the proposition that men are first formed by society and then transformed by its changing conditions. The materialist thinkers of the 18th century taught that men are what their natural and social environments make them. And they concluded from that if men were constituted by social circumstance, humanity can be improved by altering the social conditions under which they live. Marxism took over these ideas from the revolutionary materialists of France and England. It didn't originate them. Marxism also asserts that if society shapes men, men, and of course I include women in that, in turn, can reshape society through their own efforts. Indeed, this is one of the mainsprings of Marxist thought, as it always has been of revolutionary action. This idea, too, is not peculiar to Marxism. It's as old as the Greeks and has inspired all the reform and revolutionary movements since their time in the Western world. Well, then, what is distinctive about Marxist thought on this matter? It's the way that it combines these two ideas. And will you pay attention to this combination? Society forms people. Then, in turn, people transform their social relations and themselves and their selves in the process. But add the historical material. The ways in which people behave toward one another and the kind of ties they have with one another are determined both in the first instance and the final instance by the productive powers at their command. And the degree in which they can change their social relations and the direction of the evolution of their social structure depends upon the expansion of their productive powers and the economic, political, and cultural consequences of these material factors. To dramatize and illustrate these general propositions, I should like to contrast ourselves with peoples who lived in Lower California A couple of hundred years ago, the Indians, biologically, they were no different from ourselves. Yet how great a gap separated them from us socially. What different habits, what different mentalities, what different relations to one another they had. They lived under the conditions of savagery. We, under conditions of civilization. They believed, for example, that their small district was the whole world, and they were its sole inhabitant. What an extremely limited historical outlook. They had no houses. They went naked. Their diet was mainly made up of roots, fruits, small game, worms, fish, and insects, which they gathered. Referring to our anthropological discussion, they had no institution of marriage, they had no institution of fatherhood, they didn't even have the words for them. They simply mated with one another when they felt like it. They had no conception of private property, of what is mine and what is thine. They carried on no trade. And if you want to know what their intellectual life was like, their language could exhibit that very strongly. Their intellectual life was extremely impoverished. They couldn't count beyond six because the articles in their social existence were very few. They had no need to. In their speech, they didn't even have different terms for yellow and red. And the priest who studied them remarked that all terms relating to rational human and civil life and a multitude of words for signifying other objects are entirely missing. They had no words for life, death, weather. Imagine having no words for weather in Southern California. Time as such meant nothing to them. Cold, heat, rain, understanding, doubt, and so on. So much for the people who inhabited the territory a little below us a couple of hundred years ago. We have a vastly different social organization, language, mentality, custom from these primitives. Why? First of all, and most of all, because we live under different historical conditions. We are the inheritors of all the ages of the accomplishment of man. They only inherited the accomplishments of the first age of man, the age of savagery. We have an incomparably higher technology and power of production, Irving Howe's indifference to the contrary notwithstanding. Such historical conditions, such material accomplishments are decisive because they fix the framework of social action, both in its extent and in its limits at any given time. Do you think that the people of several hundred or several thousands of years from now will place us in a very different category from which we now view the primitive Indians of Southern California? I don't think so. I think we stand historically in respect to those who will come after us as the Indians stand in respect to us. And what will make the decisive difference is the difference in technology and powers of production. And everything else will and can flow from that. It's possible to outgrow these material conditions, but it is not possible to jump out of them or over them at will. And it's wrong to ignore their paramount role in making people what they are and allowing people to do what they can and cannot do at any given period. That is what Marx meant when he wrote that men make their own history, but only under the given historical conditions. At the same time, these historical conditions bring forward the major tasks that have to be accomplished by mankind, or at least by its progressive sections at any particular time. And they also determine the ways and means for accomplishing them. If we ask, what is the supreme task of our time? The answer is to abolish capitalism as an outmoded and dangerous system and proceed to create socialism on a world scale. How is this to be done? By supporting the Democratic Party, or placing faith in the United Nations, or a summit conference between the capitalist and the non-capitalist powers? Marxism teaches it can only be done through the independent action of the masses, headed by the working class. Now, in conclusion, I want to talk about the cultural and intellectual aspects of materialist humanism. Our humanism has a clear and consistent attitude toward religion. Nothing exists beyond nature and man. Nature is the generator of mankind through organic evolution. Mankind has become the producer of a nature humanized through social evolution. These grounds here are not as the Indians maintain them, they are humanized. Marxism is not agnostic. It's uncompromisingly atheistic. God did not create mankind or anything else. Man has created and recreated himself through the development of the labor process. At a certain point in their history, men created the gods in their own social image, and then, at a much higher stage of their productive powers, they began to do away with all need for the belief in divine beings. The material universe, which produces, sustains, and reabsorbs us, is the only real world. The afterlife of the churches, as well as the transmigration of, or rather the pre-incarnations or the post-incarnation of the transmigrationists, are harmful fictions. What is the mission of mankind? It's to keep perfecting human life here and now on this global platform, to bring forth the unlimited potentiality of our organism by uncovering, using, and mastering the forces and treasures of the material environment. Our ability to do so is the objective measurement of human advancement. The proud declaration of the first humanist, Protagoras the Greek, that man is the measure of all things, is somewhat too sweeping. But man is certainly the measure of all values. For socialists, there is no good higher than the fulfillment of the needs of mankind in its ascent to higher grades of social existence. Everything else is subordinate to ministering to these needs. That is why, for example, we acknowledge the necessity of slaughtering and eating animals. Because although these are living beings, mankind is a higher grade of being, and it is justified thereby for that form of life to be subordinate to promoting the life of mankind. The humanistic Socrates believed that the whole universe and its parts were prefabricated to suit humanity's welfare. Such a conception of the relation of man and the universe, which opens the door to religion, is repugnant to Marxism. Mankind is not the pampered child of creation. As a matter of fact, we're not even the pampered child of society as it exists today. But through the exertion of our natural endowment and the development of our social powers, we have proved that we can reshape nature to an increasing extent and make that part of the universe within our dominion serve our needs and support our aims. The supreme being for man is man himself. Not man as he is at any given stage, but man in the making. Man as he can be and will be. Socialist humanism recognizes that the achievements of past generations up to now has essentially consisted in preparing the conditions and raw materials for making free human beings. Mankind has had to crawl up from the animal state by barbarous means until at last he has reached the threshold where a truly human form of existence is within sight. That's why Marx designated all previous stages of social organization up to socialism as the prehistory of mankind. The distinctively human era of history will be inaugurated only with the establishment of human conditions of life, when, as Trotsky said in The Revolution Betrayed, the steady growth of social wealth has made us bipeds forget our miserly attitude toward every excess minute of labor and our humiliating fear about the size of our ration. Marxism places the active, productive human being in the very center of the historical process. Man has elevated himself through the development of his labor organization. In the socialist future, he will recreate himself from crown to toe through the steady reduction of necessary labor down to 3, 2, 1 hour a day, and the elimination of all necessary productive labor. Only when all of his time becomes free time, and it can and will become free time, to do with as he pleases, will man be able to throw off the last of his animal activities, sentiments, habits, and measures, and unstintingly cultivate his distinctively human qualities. Because the obligation to go to work every day to earn our livelihood is simply a human reproduction on a higher level of the animal's need to go out and catch his prey and to use his snout in order to feed his belly. That is still bestial. It is not distinctively human. But the time will come when we will throw off those animal needs and restraints. We can only dimly surmise what human beings of this type will be like. They'll produce wonders that will make the tapping of nuclear energy and flight into space seem like child's play. The finest quality of mankind is his creative initiative. This was displayed in the very infancy of humanity, when for the first time that higher ape picked up and used a stone or a piece of wood or bone as a tool, and then reshaped the tool, and then instead of fleeing from fire, domesticated it and used it. Such innovations have not seen their like until the present time. The development of speech as a result of working together enables us to communicate today with each other. So that the capacity for innovation has not only been a trait of exceptionally gifted individuals, it has slumbered and even been aroused in the whole of mankind. It is only under our society that the means of displaying creative initiative and enjoying and producing the higher culture has been restricted to a limited number of people. But even so, at moments of revolutionary climax in history, the oppressed masses have shown that they too are capable of creative initiative. They have summoned prodigies of social energy and enthusiasm that has swept aside archaic institutions and founded new and higher forms of social and political organization. It wasn't a few gifted men that won independence for the people of the United States and abolished slavery, that wiped the czar and the landlords and all the riffraff of capitalism away from the Soviet Union and now from China and from other countries. No, it was the mass of the people themselves in their own creative, daring do. And in the present period of revolutionary transition from class society to socialism, Marxism strives to enlighten the minds of working people and stimulate this initiative by encouraging their independent action in all domains of social activity. And that is why it is so criminal to try to tie the working people of today to such agencies of political action as are dominated by the capitalist class. This represses the initiative and independence of the American working class instead of elevating its consciousness and its activity in a progressive way. The ultimate aim of the new order is to bring about those conditions that will make creativeness the rule rather than the exception of human life. There isn't one of us here, there isn't a person in the world that doesn't feel sleeping within himself talents which do not find any means of realization. Not simply because life is so short, that will be lengthened too, but because we do not have the necessary time, the necessary means to bring them out. During this week, we have many times mentioned Tom Paine, the trumpeter of the American Revolution. When he was over in England, he was nothing but what we call today a union delegate and a labor agitator, and they drove him out of England because of that. When he came over to this country, he became a pamphleteer and a journalist, the greatest that mankind had seen up to that time. And he said, if it had not been for the American Revolution, I might never have become a writer at all. The generals of the French Revolution, they were not generals before that time. They were elevated into generals by the stirring up of society and the opening of opportunities for people down below. However, that is still the sweet music of the future. At the moment, we are living through an age of terrible terrors. What has unleashed this violence and what feeds it? It's the mighty struggle for power in the world between the defenders of the past and the preparers of the future. Progressive humanity is crossing the greatest of all borderlands in history, trying to throw off the chains of class society, of poverty, of oppression of man by man, trying to blaze a trail to a world cleansed of violence in human relations. The historical responsibility for the spread and use of violence is with the upholders of the old order, who make it impossible to survive, let alone to go forward, without resorts to means of defense and even of offense against their aggressions and attempted enslavement. The partisans of a socialism, both scientific and humanistic, have imposed upon them the paradoxical situation of having to use barbarous means to repel civilized barbarism. We are forced spectators and participants in a carnival of blood and brutality in a world we never made, but which we aspire to remake in a new image. There was a German communist writer who recently died, Bertolt Brecht. He wrote a poem to posterity in which he asked later generations to understand our predicament. Let me read you a passage from it. You who shall emerge from the flood in which we are sinking, think. When you speak of our weaknesses, also of the dark time that brought them forth, even the hatred of squalor makes the brow grow stern. Even anger against injustice makes the voice grow harsh. Alas, we who wish to lay the foundation of kindness, could not ourselves be kind. But you, when at last it comes to pass that man can help his fellow man, do not judge us too harshly. Socialist humanism believes more strongly than any other philosophy in human decency, dignity, and fraternity. But we know that in order to secure it, harsh struggle is necessary. And according to the moral code of a socialist humanism, whatever helps the exploited against the exploited and the oppressors against the oppressed, whether these be capitalists, colonialists, white supremacists, or bureaucrats, whatever actions are needed to clear the way to a free and equal society are justified and morally right. The justification for socialism itself and the means employed to establish it is that they alone can create for the first time the material and cultural prerequisites to realize the brotherhood of man preached by religion, the freedom, equality, and justice promised by bourgeois democracy, and the happiness of the whole human family on earth envisaged by the humanists of all ages. That's our sermon for this Sunday. Questions and discussion? Eleanor?
Well, it seems to me that I think you dealt with it. Humanism, as developed by liberal humanism, at a certain period will tend to disarm the working class. And it's a point for us to remember to take those parts of the humanist philosophy that will help us and to discard those parts of it which we tend to design.
The point is that liberal humanism, because of its limitations and its reliance upon the cooperation of classes, tends to disarm the working people in their struggles, and therefore we must guard against that influence. I believe that that is a correct conclusion. First of all, it disarms them in theory and in program, and then as the struggle reaches intense points, very clearly standing on the side of the warriors for the progressive position, they tend always to restrain them under the guise of moralistic admonition. It was Trotsky who said, "Please, we are in a more difficult position. We are in the right position. If you want to preach morality, you preach it to the oppressors and the exploiters. Don't try to do that, to preach peace, when the war makers, the initiators of oppression, are trying to keep the humble in their accustomed places."
Chairman, we often speak of humanity as if it were a single unit. We talk of man and people as if it were a unit that could direct itself. Actually, this is an abstraction because humanity is not a single unit, it's a collection of people, a collection of individuals. And this begs the question as to just how far, to what degree we are able to determine our destiny, to what degree we are really being pushed by circumstances, by conditions, in the direction which we go.
I'm not exactly sure what your second point was. As to the first point, that humanity is not a unit, but just an aggregate of independent human beings. When we talk of humanity, we thereby counterpose a certain species of living beings as against other living beings, such as animals, or in a lower grade, of plants. And these have distinctive abilities and capacities and destinies, which the other sections of the animal kingdom do not have. And it is in this sense that they form a distinctive unit, and certain generalizations apply to their characteristics and activities. Of course, there are many differences amongst them. I have referred to some of them today. The major difference today, of course, is between the exploiters and the exploited. But we know that there are thousands and tens of thousands of other kinds of differences. But this does not negate the fundamental identity of all members of the human species. They make their living by laboring for it, even although a part of them make their living by working other people.
Can I just make my second point?
Yes.
Equivalent to the first, I'm not disagreeing with what you say, but the second point goes out of the first point. As individuals, how can you and I, to what degree can you and I determine our destiny? Are we not being pushed by the direction in which society is going? We're just individuals.
It is true that, as I stated at the beginning, we are the result of the social conditions under which we live, and these social conditions push or pull us, drive us in certain directions. That's undeniable. However, materialism goes on to say, historical materialism, that certain sections of mankind are driven in one direction and other sections in another direction. And as the Greek says, thence comes the tug of war. And if you are a Negro in the South or a Korean, you know very well what people are pulling in what in which direction. And your study of society can lead you to understand your consciousness that there are certain directions which will bring humanity as a whole forward, and there are others which tend to make society stand still or even pull mankind backward. And it is the knowledge of this science which makes you a socialist. And the more you know, the better about it, the better socialist you are.
Well, humanism, the humanist approach inherent in socialism, Marxism, implies a certain set of values, a certain approach of what is good. And I wonder, what is the material base of that particular good? We know that there are no absolute values. There's no a priori existing in the world which tells us automatically what is good and bad. And yet you make the point, well, it's good. These things are good. Now, how would you materially base these things materially? These conclusions of what is good for humanity, what human beings should bend their efforts for?
To say that one thing or one action is good and another bad is, of course, to evaluate them according to some standard. Now, what is the standard that a scientific socialist uses to say whether any given action or any given object is good or bad? Things are not good or bad in themselves. Fire, to take a familiar example, was the first natural chemical process put to use by mankind. Fire, as we know, can burn down a city, or it can build up a city through its use in industrial process and for other domestic uses. It is the same with any other activity of a human being. Let us take the most terrible. Certainly, it is wrong to take human life, because human life is the greatest of all goods, so far as we're concerned, the basis of all the others. And yet, sometimes there are conditions when one is categorically obliged, however repugnant it may be, to do that. Let me take a simple example. There are three people on a raft, and they have no food. It is possible that two of them can reach their destination if they eat the third. Now, let's put it crudely. Is it worthwhile for them to eat the third in order to save the lives of the other two? Now, that has happened time and again in human history. You can be a universal moralist and say, no, under no conditions is it advisable for one human being to use up the biological existence of another. But then let us pose a final condition. Suppose they were the only three people on Earth, and the perpetuation of the human species is at stake. What sense is there from the standpoint of humanity and morality to permit all three human beings to perish and our species with them for the sake of your general moral rule? As a materialist, I see no sense in it. Now, this is an extreme case, but it's useful to draw things out to their conclusion, because there you see the fundamental content of opposing positions. It is the same in our society today. We all know that there come times when push comes to shove, when it is necessary to pass beyond reasonable argument and even to slap a child, not as a rule, but possibly as an exception, in order to save it from a greater danger. In the struggle of the society itself, it is necessary to take up arms occasionally in order to secure progressive objectives. The American people have done that in the War of Independence and in the Civil War and on other occasions. It may well be necessary that in order to defend themselves and go forward, that one will have to put human lives at stake. Not simply that of the people who would rob others of lives of liberty, but our own. And we believe, too, that that is justified. It is not simply a question of taking the lives of others. It is a question of putting our own lives in the balance, is it not? We are obliged to do that. And yet, for the sake of higher aims, we are willing to do that. And the justification for it is, the sole justification that I know of, is that it contributes to the advancement of mankind and the defense of its acquisition. Wait a second. Well, all right, sure.
Well, I think that what justifies it is human need. I believe that the two people on the raft determined to dispose of the third because they're hungry. I don't know that the consciousness of the development of a rational society is a thing that drifts them. I think it's pure hunger. And that's what determines. They probably at that stage have forgotten everything about philosophy, theory, consciousness, they had at all. And the need, therefore, determines in this example, in my opinion, as well as in the broader approach to the whole question of the human relations. I think you said that, but I felt that...
In my hypothetical example, I assumed that they were cultured people who would have a conflict between their biological needs and their inherited social values and ethical standards. However, I may point out, to back up your point by historical development, you know there was a time in the history of humanity, as Evelyn pointed out, when one part of humanity did feed upon another, when cannibalism was a universal practice. Now, what are we going to do, condemn those people back there because they were cannibals? After all, we're the product of what they accomplished. Of course, we've thrown that over. We no longer want to resort to cannibalism. But we recognize that the cannibals have more justification than the present-day rulers of society who slaughter mankind and do not even eat them.
Philosophy, it embraces and overlaps all sections of the population. civilization. But what is it under, what is it as a socialist humanism? Does it then become a class philosophy, or does it also integrate all sections of the population?
Socialist humanism is distinguished from liberal humanism in that it bases itself firmly upon the proposition that since society is divided into antagonistic classes, if you want to be humanistic, rational, and scientific, and progressive, you must base the progressive movement upon the struggles of the working people and their allies against those sections of humanity which are trying to uphold the old order. That this, in turn, will lead to the creation of a society, a world of social solidarity, when antagonisms between different sections of mankind no longer exist. The trouble with liberal humanism is that they presuppose what has yet to be accomplished, and thereby lead mankind astray, in theory first and then in practice. It would be nice if it were so. Which one of us would not want to embrace the capitalists and the white supremacists and the imperialists and say, brother, let us march down the highway to peace, freedom, and equality together. But what could I or could you give that advice to people? Not if you're rational, you couldn't.
They won't listen to us.
They won't listen. They have to be lying. They
do by ballot.
Further comments or questions? Okay, that's the end of this educational program.